We'll call to order the meeting of the State Government Finance Division. Start out with Representative Hewitt. Did you get a chance to look at the minutes?
Mr. Chair, I have, and so move the minutes of March 10th. Oops, sorry.
March 5th.
March 5th.
Representative Hewitt moves the approval of the minutes for March 5th, 2020. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. Welcome to the committee. I'll move that House File 3356 be referred to the General Register. And welcome to the committee, Representative Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the Department of Administration agency bill updating obsolete references related to the state register and modifying the due date and requirements for the capital events report. I'd first like to start by offering the A1 author's amendment that I believe you have copies of.
I'll move the 3356 A1 amendment. You want to explain what this does? And
essentially, it just changes the reference of the number of reports from 10 to one physical property. One physical copy.
Physical copies. Members, does everybody understand what the amendment does? If not, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment's added.
This then matches the current practice and is supported by admin procedure along with other libraries. Aaron Campbell, Assistant Commissioner, is here to make my life very simple at the Department of Administration here with me to help explain the bill.
Welcome to the committee, and our agenda head you as Jones, so so introduce yourself for the recording.
Sure. Good morning. My name is Erin Campbell. I'm one of the assistant commissioners at the Department of Administration. This is one of our agency cleanup bills. It does just a couple of pretty minor things. It reduces the number of copies now that we have to send to the Legislative Reference Library of the State Register, and eliminates the number of copies we need to send to county libraries. It also changes the date of the capital events report from August 1st to September 15th, and that just allows us a little bit more time at the close of the fiscal year to get that in order. And it also changes limits a report to events for which fees were paid, which we believe was the original intent of the legislature, instead of all of the events that take place on the Capitol complex, which is quite a number. And that's it.
Any questions for the testifier? Representative Albright.
Thank you. Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair. Representative Salk and Ms. Campbell, I'm just curious why you would exclude events for which a fee is not collected.
Ms. Campbell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, the report was required when admin began collecting fees for events in the Capitol a couple of years ago. After the Capitol reopened, it coincided with that event. And so we currently submit the report with all of the events, but we think what the legislature was really trying to get at was the more limited number of events for which fees are charged.
Representative Albright.
Ms. Campbell, I appreciate your desire to be brief in that, but I would caution you to move towards considering what you believe legislative intent is. That has doomed some other people to their great peril. So the report that you propose going to would only include those or would no longer include all events held at the Capitol?
Ms. Campbell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, that's correct.
Representative Albright.
I'm just considering why you would not have a register of all activities at the Capitol.
Ms. Campbell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, we technically do. It's just a matter of making the report simpler. I mean, we are keeping track of the events that take place in the Capitol.
Ms. Campbell, can somebody get those if they request a list of all those?
Mr. Chair, they certainly could.
Representative Albright.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just close with, I think that the uniformity of providing the public with a record of all activities at the Capitol, whether it's cumbersome or not, I do think it's our responsibility to provide a means by which the public has access to that in one record that from precedent has been used in the past. So I would not be in favor of this.
Any further questions? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 3356, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion passes.
Thank you.
And the next bill on our agenda is House File 11. Representative Lesh, welcome to our committee. And I'll move House File 11 to be referred to the General Register. And Representative Lesh, tell us about your bill.
Well, Ms. Chair, and you want me to go through the whole bill, or do you want me to, is this more just about the fiscal note portion we're talking about? Because if that's the case, I'd defer to fiscal staff on that.
The AG cost is what we have purview over. So if you concentrate on that,
okay.
The fiscal note.
If I could have fiscal staff speak to that, then the AG cost.
Mr. Chair and members, I think you're referring to another bill when you talk about AG costs. The cost in House File 11?
House File 11, MMB.
Yes.
My mistake.
I was deferred to the chair, Mr. Chair.
There are two agencies in the fiscal note that are under the purview of this committee. The first is the Office of Administrative Hearings. And if you look at page 12 of the fiscal note, you'll see a discussion of the time that office would charge for administrative law judges for hearing some appeals and rulemaking. And that office is funded through a revolving fund. So there is not a cost to the general fund. The second piece in the second agency under this committee's purview is Minnesota Management and Budget. That discussion starts on page 15. There are two parts to the fiscal note that you relate to this bill. The first is $11,000 in direct costs to MMB for translation and printing costs. And you'll see that reflected also in the appropriation in the bill on lines 13.16 to 13.18. In addition, the fiscal note also reflects what we call enterprise costs. Those would be the cost to state agencies for additional coverage of state employee costs. And so that is an enterprise cost that's not reflected in a direct appropriation, but would occur to state agencies as employees took advantage of this new benefit. And I think I would point you to on page 16, the fourth bullet down talks about how the fiscal note assumes no additional staffing costs for most agencies. However, it is assumed that staffing changes will be necessary at agencies that have 24-hour coverage. So that would be, for example, Human Services, Corrections, and Veterans. And so the enterprise costs reflected in the fiscal note also reflect a 38% would accrue to the general fund across the enterprise, and then the remaining to other funds. And that's just based on the general payroll.
Questions, members? So you have a testifier that is she there for support, or does she have something to say?
Good morning.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
My name is Dori Leland. I'm one of the enterprise directors at Minnesota Management and Budget. I oversee the HR data analytics section that provided the numbers that supported the costs that are associated with this fiscal note. An excellent summary of how the costing was done, but if anybody has any questions about how we got to those numbers, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Not seeing anybody raising their hands and jumping up. With that, Representative Lesh, you want to sum up?
Sure. Well, Mr. Chair, it's a good bill. As we all know, what's happening globally and nationally right now, the costs associated with people getting each other sick are substantial. The Dow dropped 2,000 points, the biggest drop since the subprime crash 2008. When I first started on this bill, it was before the subprime crash. It was 2007. And the costs assessed by the National Chamber of Commerce was over $6 billion in presenteeism back then associated with people showing up, getting your other workers sick, and then you as an employer having to take the hit for that. So this, in the long run, and at that time, Mr. Chair, there was only one jurisdiction that had paid sick days. That was San Francisco. Since then, there are over 40 jurisdictions, and I think 10 or 11 states that have passed some version of it. And the chicken little skies falling hoo-ha that had occurred before that, you ask those folks afterwards, like, no, this is probably a pretty good program. It helps us all a lot, and that's coming from businesses. So we'd ask for the support, and I'd leave it at that.
And members, the reason we're hearing this bill was part of the jobs bill, I believe, last year. And it didn't make it through the end. And last year, the chair of the jobs committee was going to eat the cost for this in his target. That's why it didn't come to us last year. It came back, and that's why it has to come to us this year, because there is cost to us. So with that, members, I'll renew my motion that House File 11 be referred to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're on your way. The next bill we have is House File 505. Representative Fisher, welcome to the committee. And members, I'll move that House File 505 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. And welcome to the committee, Mr. Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee, appreciate the opportunity to present House File 505 to you. This is a bill that came to idea that came to me several years ago, back in 2017. The two young gentlemen to the left of me here contacted me with concerns about how boring our state flag was and how it really doesn't fit how a state flag should be designed, how flags should be done these days. And that was part of a school project they had. So lo and behold, a school project that they started 2 years ago where they had to contact the representative has now turned to the point where they're able to present to another committee here at this Minnesota House. The idea was to originally create a state task force, and this is what the bill does, is create a state task force to look at the state flag and figure out is there a better design that we should be using. And it's directing the task force to come together, bring in experts who deal with flag issues. I can't pronounce the word. Fortunately, these two gentlemen can. And what it will do is it would ask for a report to come back to the legislature by January 15th of 2021. The task force itself would not change the state flag, but it would make recommendations to the state legislature, and then the state legislature would be able to act on it. At this point in time, I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers here. The first testifier will be Mr. Tom Akins, and I will turn it over to him at this point to start the presentation.
And Mr. Akins, if you can, and Mr. Kalkman, if you can introduce yourselves for the tape, state your name for the tape, and then proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Thomas Atkins. I'm a student at the University of Minnesota, and we thank you for the opportunity to present our take on the current state flag. Good design, whether it be a logo, architecture, or a flag, often captures our interest, and when done correctly, can be an instantly recognizable symbol of a concept or place. Citizens in a region with a well-designed flag often feel proud to be under the flag and what it represents. For example, Chicago's flag is the platonic ideal of a flag that inspires citizen pride. The flag's success is measured by its omnipresence. It is seen both flying from buildings and on souvenir merchandise. The citizens of Chicago clearly take great pride in their flag and revere it to the point where police officers are often buried with the Chicago flag rather than the American flag. Respect for a flag is strongly correlated with good design, and so in order to understand why some flags are seen more frequently than others, we turn to NAVA, or the North American Vexillological Association's Five Principles of Flag Design. These principles were compiled by Ted Kay, a vexillologist, or one who studies flags, by observing patterns in flags that were flown with pride, compared to flags that were all but unknown from disuse. The first guideline is arguably the most important when evaluating designs. Keep it simple enough that a child could draw it from memory. Simple shapes and patterns not only allow the flag to be recreated and recognized easily, but also reduce costs of production. While using simple shapes and colors, one must also use meaningful symbolism to illustrate what the flag stands for. The symbolism should be widely recognizable by citizens, yet clearly understood from an outside perspective. The colors on the flag should also be kept as simple as possible. as using a limited number of colors ensures that the flag is not too busy. Furthermore, writing and seals on flags are both problematic. A good flag should not literally spell out what it represents, as writing what you are trying to represent on your flag defeats the purpose of symbols. Additionally, seals are meant for close viewing on documents, where small details can be distinguished, but on a flag potentially flying hundreds of feet away, small details run together and can't be identified. Seals and flags have different purposes, so they should stay separate entities. The final principle is to be distinct or be related. Using similar elements as other flags can show connection, but designs should avoid being so similar that it begins to become difficult to distinguish flags from each other. The Minnesota flag fails all five guidelines. For reference, here's the state flag flying in St. Paul. The design is not simple. The flag must be screen printed rather than sewn, increasing production costs, and no child could draw it from memory. In fact, the flag is so complicated, you may not have recognized that in this picture, the flag is accidentally flying upside down. The flag fails the second guideline, use meaningful symbolism, because while there are many symbols on the flag, they are so cluttered in the seal that the symbolism is hard to distinguish and lost on many. Ask a Minnesotan what their flag symbolizes and many won't know. The violations of points 3 and 4 are obvious. The flag uses 7 colors and the word Minnesota is written on the flag in the state seal. Finally, point 5's instruction is to be distinct or be related. While a state legislator may be able to find Minnesota among these 20 similar state flags, the average Minnesotan cannot. The flag fails to be distinct, but is too related to other state flags to be easily distinguishable. In a 2001 State and Provincial Flag Survey, NAVA hosted a poll on their website asking its members and the public about flag designs in the U.S. and Canada. It lasted around 3 months, and around 100 NAVA members and 300 members of the public cast around 29,000 votes by the end of the survey, the results of which are shown in this graph. Flags with no seal are green, flags with a seal but without a blue background are in yellow, and flags with a seal and a blue background are shown in blue. The chart makes it evident that seals, especially on flags with a blue background, diminish a flag's standings both in the eyes of professionals and the public. Minnesota's flag ranks 67th out of 72 flags with a score of 3.1 out of 10, clear evidence of a subpar flag. Thank you.
Welcome, Jack Kalkman. State your name for the record.
Jack Kalkman, I go to Michigan Tech. Peg Hay of NAVA states, one does not need to be a flag expert to know a good flag design. So foregoing the principles of flag design typically leads to less popularity and recognition. One only infrequently sees the Minnesota flags flying prominently outside a government building. Minnesota's flag does not catch the eye, nor retain a viewer's gaze, nor hold a place in citizens' hearts. Popularity is the ultimate measure of a good flag. So the lack of support makes a pretty clear case that our state flag does not fulfill its purpose. Therefore, to address our substandard flag, we are asking you to continue the progress of House File 505. The bill would not change the flag directly, but rather set up a task force to study design changes. So by passing the bill, you're not committing to a new state flag, merely deciding to look into the issue. Furthermore, the bill would allow task force members to solicit voluntary aid and service of vexillologists and other persons who have either technical or artistic skill in flag construction and design. To see how this could be done, one doesn't have to look much farther than Duluth. Last year, the city of Duluth held a public contest to redesign their city flag. 195 flag designs were submitted by 98 designers, ranging from 5 to 7 years old, from which a volunteer committee chose 9 finalists, which the public voted on. The Duluth City Council adopted this design as their new flag of August and last year and is now in place since January. The process not only allowed those with artistic skill to participate, but also citizens got involved with their government. A number of individuals have already been creating new vexillologically sound designs, some of which are shown here. Many emphasize Minnesota's natural beauty and identity as the North Star State, much more revealing than our state's character than a seal on a blue background. For those of you worried about the economic cost of a new flag, this could potentially be offset by the additional merchandising and tourism revenue that a flag could bring, And furthermore, the cost of production of a well-designed flag would be much lower, as well-designed flags are simpler and often can be sewn instead of screen printed. While short-term costs may be incurred, the flag could pay itself off in the longer run. Let's consider the purpose of a flag. A proper flag is a recognizable symbol of a region, flown with pride by its citizens. We Minnesotans have pride in our state, and deservingly so. We have top-ranked public university, our natural beauty rivals that of any other state, and we're stereotyped to being too nice. We're the star of the North, the Toit du Nord. We have so much to be proud of, and we all deserve to be expressed that with our state expressing our state pride by flying a much well-designed flag. Therefore, we expect respectfully asking this committee to advance the progress of House File 505 in order to get Minnesotans the flag we all deserve. Thank you.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you to my testifiers. I very much appreciate their expertise on this and would like to open it up for questions at this point in time.
And members, any questions? Representative Ball raised on there. I just first want to say, when you talked about the contest, it reminded me the last Friday when I watched Almanac, the week before, the question had been, how or when was our state bird selected and how was it selected? And there was a contest, and the students back in the 50s chose the scarlet tanager and passed that on to the legislature, and the legislature, in its wisdom, chose to ignore that and picked the loon. So that was the question on Almanac, is what is, you know, when, how did our state bird get a neck pick? So anyway, Representative Albright.
Madam, Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Fisher and to the testifiers, I want to revert back to a couple of the things that you've mentioned in your presentation. Thank you, by the way. Can you revert back to slide number 6?
Hi, I'm Bixby.
Sorry, guys. I don't see Bixby up there, but
I was really trying to shut it off.
One of the observations that I would ask is, in the legislative process, we deal with subjective points of view as well as objective information views. Where does NABA fall in terms of, is this Mr. Bixby? Where do we fall in terms of, is this leaning more towards an objective or a subjective review of the flags that are portrayed on here and in your other slides?
Thank you. So I would say that there's definitely both subjective and objective components to flag design. Of course, some people are going to think that certain flags look better than others. It's a question of aesthetics. But the question, I think, is that how is a flag measured in terms of its success? And I think we say that a flag's success is measured by its popularity. And these points, these principles, they've not been compiled by some vexillologist sitting in an ivory tower think, what do I want flags to look like? They've been compiled by examining flags that the public used and the public liked versus essentially flags that the public didn't know and didn't use. And I'd say Minnesota's flag currently falls into the category where the public doesn't really know what it is and doesn't use it because it's not expressing Minnesota's brand accurately.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going to the vexillological perspective, and you're taking a look at subjective in terms of, you mentioned the popularity or recognition of a flag. Is that subjective or objective based upon the criteria that you set out?
Mr. Atkins.
I would say that popularity can be measured objectively.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. How would you go about that?
Mr. Atkins.
Essentially, I would measure it in essentially a contest like this, where both members of the public and people that are, you know, familiar with the field of vexillology would be able to rank votes, and essentially you'd see clusterings of flags that the public and those with artistic skill both liked. And in the results of the survey, I won't go into the more detailed results here, but the public generally agreed with the vexillological view that simpler design flags were better and that flags with seals generally were viewed less favorably in both parties.
Members, this is kind of getting what the task force would do, but Representative Albright.
And to that point, Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, you lay out that a task force is going to be established, who would you envision, or it doesn't lay out in terms of the components of what the task force, who would be involved in that task force? I see Mr. Kelleher in the audience, and so would the Historical Society, who would you envision being on the task force?
Representative
Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In terms of the task force, I would imagine that the task force itself primarily would be composed of people appointed from both the House and the Senate. From there, they would be able to bring public in. I would imagine that for the task force, that we would be involving people from who are flag experts. We'd probably involve people from the Historical Society. It'd be some of the first groups that we'd be having involved with, that number one, so that we've got the historical context of how things evolved over time, and also help them provide some of the state history. I would also imagine that as we're going forward, that we'd probably be at a point where we'd be soliciting designs in, working with flag experts that would help guide us through that process, and then eventually making a recommendation back through to the legislature. And I would envision that we would use some kind of survey process in the in terms of, once we've got the field of flags narrowed down, is putting some kind of public opinion poll out there to get their opinion too and find out what their thoughts are to help guide us in the process.
Representative Albright.
Sure. Does it require a constitutional amendment to change our flag?
Representative Albright, I don't believe so, but maybe Mr. Gehring can has that answer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, the safe flag is described in statute, so you can amend statute to change it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and simplistic in popularity reminds me of emojis. This task force would have been great probably before we picked the state flag. But since then, there's been some history. The first Minnesotan didn't care, that division didn't care about the popularity of their flag when they fought in the Civil War. And they shed blood in the Civil War. So at some point, we should care about the history of the flag. And, you know, depending on what criteria, if we do the task force, when I hear popular and simple, I think of emojis, and I just, you know, have concerns of a moment in time, we pick a new flag, and we forget the history. But I did, on House File 11, notice in the materials that they didn't use a staple, and it actually was functional. So I must commend staff or whoever utilized this as a better way of giving us our materials, so we don't have staples. It's easier to process, and we don't use up steel.
Well, Representative, I was just whispering in my ear that all the copy machines that we currently have in the state office building do this instead of stapling them. So I guess that's, I learned something new today also. I've seen that, yes. I've seen that on other bills and other notes that we've gotten. Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Mr. Adkins and Mr. Kalkman. Before you leave today, I would invite you to walk over to the Capitol building. When I think about simplicity and representation, the floor of the rotunda has an awesome design on it that also incorporates the block M. And when I think about what our new flag could look like, I do think it should represent the people of Minnesota. And I thank you for bringing this forward. The people of Plymouth have been asking for something like this for a while, so I think it's a great idea. And to see a school project turn into a passion and then to testifying an activity in the state capitol, I think is really awesome. So thank you for being here today. And history is fluid, and it changes with time. And I think this is a new time in our state where we are more inclusive and more accepting of many, many people. And so I think adapting our flag to represent everyone is a really good thing. So thank you for being here today.
Another comment, Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank Representative Fisher and Mr. Atkins and Kaufman for bringing this bill forward. Two observations. One was when I was running for office, I had two individual people bring me their own flag designs because they believed that our current flag design was, to your point, non-memorable and not particularly compelling. And so this is an issue that constituents in my district are very concerned about. And then when I lived in D.C., our flag was pretty similar to the Chicago flag, and everybody flew it. People wore D.C. flag T-shirts. I saw people with D.C. flag tattoos. There were, D.C. flags in a bunch of houses. And I think that speaks to the recognizable nature of a flag being really popular and compelling. So I just want to thank you for your work, and I fully support it.
So Representative Long, would you have to then get your Minnesota flag tattoo redone?
Yes, only if it became compelling, though. So far I've held off, resisted the urge.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't anticipating a tattoo, but to the testifier that talked about the tourism uptick with the flag, just curious how you see that unfolding, because I was just taken a little bit back with how would that actually increase tourism? I think that came up in one of the testifiers.
Representative Fisher.
If I could, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel. I think where a lot of that comes into is it's a brand. You know, our flag becomes a brand. As the brand gets out there, more people recognize what it stands for. And it's kind of like Target. You know, everyone recognizes that big red dot, you know, Target with the dot in it. You know, you don't have to have the word Target under it, and that is what companies use that helps drive people to come to their stores. Likewise, you think of one of the ways to think of the state flag is this is the brand of our state, and the more recognizable it is, more people start residing in the back of my mind. Oh yeah, that's the flag of Minnesota. And if it's designed well, you've got whether it's a North Star or the waves that are on there with the blue and the red, it starts gives the impression of tourism. It may help increase that visibility of what our state is, that we're not just a tundra covered with snow most of the year, that we actually have a lot of different variety out here. And in turn, that increases the likelihood that the people are going to know who we are and come and venture to our state, therefore driving tourism. Comes about that whole brand image.
Mr. Aikens.
If I may speak to that as well. So this is kind of a pertinent example. It's spring break right now for high schools and universities everywhere, and a lot of people are going to be taking trips to Colorado. And when they come back, usually they have a sticker or a pin or a T-shirt or a hoodie that has the Colorado flag on it. And I think partly what's driving Colorado's tourism is that when people go there, they have the unified brand of the state flag. You could walk around the halls of our old high school and you'd see Colorado flags everywhere, not flying, but on people's T-shirts or on their backpacks. And so I think that's definitely an example of how tourism and good flag design can both help each other.
Representative Waldo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the follow-up question to that is, if then through these discussions, you're also going to make integral part of those discussions the cost of changing a brand. And I'm not disagreeing with what you're talking about, but when you've had a brand that's been around for as long as this and you start changing it, not only is it the cost of the flag, but it's the cost of everything that goes with it and all those businesses that own flags and everything else that are flying it. And I'm wondering how you're going to approach that in this group so that we get a holistic kind of summary of what will come from this.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Vogel. I'm making notes to make sure that we keep that part in mind, and I think one of the things that first comes to mind is that while the state may have an overall brand of who we are, our flag doesn't represent that right now. Most people don't even recognize what the state flag is when they see it. Number two, I don't really ever see our state flag on anybody's shirts, on their backpacks, et cetera. So in some ways, I think when we start laying it out from that aspect, we're going to find that we've got a lot of opportunities to have greater appeal and greater opportunity for that image to be displayed than we definitely do now.
Representative Vogel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, if this is going to proceed, I really think that needs to be part of the discussion, because whether or not people like the flag or not, it is something that is really our brand on flagpoles and the state as a whole. So I think we would be remiss if we didn't really look at both sides of this and make sure that before we do this, we know what we're getting into, because it's going to affect a lot of different things. Thank you.
Representative Keel, you'll be the last questioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to kind of go a little farther than Representative Vogel. When we talk about our brand, first of all, young men, I really thank you for this project, and I always like seeing high school students come here and have a conversation about different issues. I get a little concerned about just picking a moment in time. That flag to me says a lot about Minnesota. And when I look at the, I know it's hard to see, but when I look at that, it describes Minnesota. It isn't just the Star of the North. We are an agricultural state, very large in agriculture. It says that. It says there's at least what my description in my brain is. It talks about mining, and there's water there. And we're proud of all of those things. And so that talks about who we are and what we represent. And so if we're going to consider changing the flag to make it simplify, we also want to tell people who we are. And I think that that's an important thing to remember, all of the investment that, or all of how Minnesota's been developed. And so I get a little concerned about just taking a moment in time and saying, here's what we should do, when in fact we need to think back at how we were developed and where we've gone. So it's just something for thought. And I thank you, boys, for young men, for you know, participating, and wish you the best in this project.
And members, that's what the commission would, all those things that the last few things we talked about is what the commission would do. Gentlemen, the only thing I can see that in your presentation that you might have slowed down was the when you showed the Duluth flag, and we could have asked our representative from Duluth if she knew what the flag was. Anyway, with that, members, I'll renew my motion that House File 505 be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion is passed. Thank you. Next bill we've got is House File 4190, Mr. Representative Petersburg. Yeah, I did see him come in. Welcome to the committee. And I'll move House File 4190 to be held over for further consideration. We don't have a target yet, so we don't know what we can spend any money on. So. Representative Petersburg, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate you hearing this bill, and I'll authorize the budget target for you to get this done, if that will help. So. Excuse me. So this bill really is something that came across fairly quickly, and it refers to the Hoffman apiaries in Waseca County. An apiary is actually deals with bees and honey, and we are dealing with pollinators right now, and so I think it's very appropriate. I believe this is the only apiary that has qualified for the National Registry for Preservation, and a few years ago it was placed on that registry, and it is in the process of being renovated, and I will turn over to testifier in just a few minutes. And you'll see in the packet some information about it. You'll see a letter from the Historical Society through the funding process. Now, it did qualify for one level of funding to get it started, and because of the restrictions on funding, it didn't make the cut on the second go-around. And so the problem we have here is that the contracts that started this process are up for renewal, and if we aren't able to fulfill them, we'll have to start over again. And so with that, I'll allow my testifier, Joan Mooney, who is the chair of the Waseca Historical Society, give you kind of an update in her perception about this project.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Joan Mooney. I'm an executive director for the Waseca County Historical Society. I'm going to read this so I don't forget anything, and it's very brief. I am here asking for your help on behalf of the Society and Hoffman Apiaries, a farm site near Waseca that is on the National Register of Historic Places and with which we have partnered. An apiary is a site on which hives of honeybees are located. Hoffman Apiaries operated from 1902 to 1985, and during the 1920s was the largest producer of honey in Minnesota. The business became known and respected nationally, and father and son made numerous and significant contributions to the industry on both national and regional stages. Hoffman Apiaries is one of only three sites on the National Register of Historic Places having to do with honeybees. It is unique in that the site and its buildings are still intact and serviceable. I first visited there in 2010, and during a tour of the site was fascinated by the history and the remarkable condition of the existing structures. This experience launched me on the path that has brought me here today. Between 2014 and 2018, the Waseca County Historical Society has obtained grants totaling over $40,000 that allowed us to acquire an evaluation of the site for nomination to the National Register, the documentation necessary for the nomination, the interpretive plan, and construction documents to restore two buildings, the honey house and the wax shed. In 2018, we proposed a two-phase plan to the State Historic Preservation Office outlining the restoration of the two buildings. 2018, we were awarded $163,000 for phase one, which has just concluded. However, we were denied our request for phase two funding to complete the project. The cultural heritage grants carried the project to this point. We feel great gratitude for the legacy dollars that have trickled into our small rural communities through the cultural heritage and arts grants. However, there just is not enough money in that pool. And we are, of course, invited to submit again, but our financial situation does not provide a cash match, which is not required, but makes a stronger case. So that has not changed, and we don't foresee it changing. So here I am. And this is something I envisioned from the very start of this project. And I said, if I have to stand in front of the Minnesota State Legislature and ask for money, I will. Because this project is pertinent, it's worthy, and it's sustainable. So this is just a one-time ask.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to give you a little bit more history about it, we also very appreciative of the History Center and History Society, Historical Society, for supporting this program up to this point. And I know that they have no problem with the program. They really think it's a great program. Unfortunately, when you're stuck with two or three times the requests for the funds available, decisions have to be made. And so this is kind of a special request for that. And we would love to stay with the grant program process, and we'll continue to do so. One of the things else to be known about the Waseca County regional area, along with that, we have Farm America, which is also an educational learning center that is something that certainly could be utilized also. We really are trying to figure out how we can help the bee industry and with the husbandry and nurturing of that. We also have AURI, which is a research part in Waseca, as well as the Southern Research Outreach Center through the University of Minnesota. So Waseca County is kind of a hub of development resources and research for agriculture in all different aspects of our agricultural industry. So it's a hotbed of work, and it's worthy of support if this so choose. Thank you.
I also have David Kelleher on the agenda from the Historical Society. Welcome to the committee. Again, please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society. I'm really here to answer any questions that you may have and provide some additional context on the grant programs that we operate. And the largest grant program that we operate is the Legacy Funded Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund Grants Program. Over the life of the Legacy Amendment, we have provided nearly 2,600 grants across the state in all 87 counties. It's been really successful, $50+ million. As the handout you have indicates, the competition is fierce for those dollars. In the last round, there was about $10 million in requests for about $4 million available. And the Citizen Review Committee, that are all volunteers that make recommendations on those grants, have a tough job. And they have to make some difficult decisions on which ones go forward and which ones don't. They had a few questions that they discussed about this particular grant request and wrestled with that. And as the letter said, anyone who doesn't receive a grant is welcome to resubmit in the next grant round, and the grants office, our staff, are available to help make a better grant application. Their goal is not to stop any grant application. Their philosophy and goal is to have successful projects go forward. And this certainly is a great project. I've been to visit there a number of years ago, and as has been discussed, with all the attention being paid to the importance of pollinators, this is important to have it move forward to educate the public. But we do have a process that we follow for grants, so your policy decision is whether you want to follow that process on the legacy side. This is a general fund request as opposed to a legacy request, but that's how this fits into the context of those various grant programs, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you speak to how many people are impacted by the programming? Like, how many folks actually come through and take part in programming and events at the apiary?
Ms. Mooney.
We have not started the programming yet because we are halfway through stabilizing the structures. We have completed phase one, and phase two needs was the next step. So we do not have those numbers at this time.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many do you anticipate being impacted by?
Ms. Mooney. That's okay. We're scary people, I know.
Yes. we anticipate this will have statewide interest. Just regionally, the schools' annual visits will bring in thousands of students. We have the beekeeping industry that's waiting in the wings to jump in and help us with the pollinator end of the programming. So in our interpretive plan, we did consider all of these things. The site is accessible for parking, this and that, although it is an old historic site, and at this time we are working with some local grant money to establish a video tour for people who cannot climb up the multi-levels of the honey house, so we can be accessible that way as well. We have spent a lot of time on this project thinking of every possible scenario, and we're ready to roll.
Representative Wilson.
Just one more question. This is, I love the idea of the apiaries and pollinators and all that. Is the Hoffman Apiaries, is that its own company? Do they do their own thing and sell their own product through this facility too?
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Olson. Currently, the family is no longer producing. That's the reason for the historical significance of it. It has been, and the Waseca County Historical Society wants to not only preserve it, but bring it back to where we can show off what it was in its previous form, and to be an educational piece rather than necessarily a working one. Although with the beekeepers around, I have no doubt that there will be active beekeeping at that particular time, and maybe Ms. Mooney can expound upon that.
Ms. Mooney.
Yes, this project was stumbled upon when I attended the estate sale for Charlie Hoffman, who was 101 years old, known as the Bee Guy. And that is when I was shocked and surprised that this barn that I was going into was nothing like a barn I'd ever seen before, because it was a honey house. So what Larry and Jan Hoffman did when settling the estate, they were passionate about preserving the legacy. So Charlie's son Larry, who's an artist who lives in Minneapolis, and his wife Jan is a teacher, bought out the other three siblings so that we could hold on to this legacy. So we are not right now launching a business plan per se. That will be up to what evolves through the pollinator programs that we will be hopefully working with the University of Minnesota, the USDA. And if they decide to start to produce honey again, we have a very strict county health department that we would have to work with. But our focus mainly is on interpretive education.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess my question was, so it is still privately owned by the family, yes, that the programming runs through. So the family could start up their own, it's their facility, they could start up. Mm-hmm. And just kind of wondering then how that state funds went to essentially fix up their building that then they could run their own business through.
Mm-hmm. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I believe the Historical Society and the family do have an agreement on the uses of the property, and I think that is one of the areas where even the Historical Society has a little bit of concerns about tightening that up so that the interests of the state and the investment stays with the state and the investment. But at this point, there is a use agreement that the county has with the family to maintain it as an interpretive center.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kelleher, I mentioned there were 71 applications. How many applications were not granted from in the last round?
Mr. Kelleher.
Mr. Chair, Representative Long, I'm sorry, I don't have the number at my fingertips, but I think fewer than half were funded, and I just don't have the exact number, but it's very, very competitive. The dollar figure is on the letter that you have, and it's 10 million available, and or 10 million requested and 4 million funded. So very competitive. I'm sorry, I don't have the number of grants. So but
more than 35. And I guess I just, this seems like a great project. It feels tough for me to assess, you know, if we had any other of the 35 folks come before us, which would be more worthy than the other. You all have professional team that is assembled to do that. How often, Mr. Kelleher, do grant applicants not receive a grant in 1 year but receive a grant in subsequent years?
Mr. Kelleher.
Mr. Chair, Representative Long, that happens fairly frequently, that it takes a couple of tries. And as I mentioned earlier, our grants office staff is working hard to make sure that grant applicants prepare a successful application. That's their goal in the end. But it is competitive, and it does often take a few tries to get through the process.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Seeing none, this is going to be Representative Petersburg. You want to wrap up?
Yes, if I could. The challenge here is that the Historical Society in Waseca County and has gone through this already, and phase one was granted and approved. And now it feels like they're kind of left hanging, and it's no fault of anybody's. It's just the way the competition is going. But in this particular case, it will put us into a bigger drawback later. And because it was worthy for the first go around, it should be worthy for us at least attention if we can provide the funds for it this year as well. So I just ask for your consideration in that. And thank you for hearing the bill. I appreciate it, and I appreciate the Historical Society too.
Thank you, and members, with that, we'll hold this over for further considerations, and hopefully the stuff that's happened in the last week doesn't lower whatever target we may have been going to get to zero. So with that, members, thank you. And members, with that, we have our agenda is done, and so we're adjourned.